And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I am one of your hosts, Jason Jacknetti, but I'm not alone on this journey. I am joined by, of course, the OG of the Two True Freaks Network, Chris Honeywell.
That's me.
And, of course, I'm joined by my brother, Mr. Luke Jacknetti.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
And Hero could not be here tonight. He sends his well wishes as much as Hero sends well wishes.
I was going to say, Hero sends his well wishes in that he doesn't send any particular harm.
Exactly. Right. That is how we describe how Hero would say this. But we are not alone. We do have a special guest tonight, folks. We have a gentleman with us who some of our listeners will know already because we've seen a number of his, you know, the documentaries he's done, Mr. David Weiner.
Hey, I'm here. You guys have seen some?
Oh, yeah. I'll be honest with you. I've backed every single thing you guys have put. So once I heard about the one about the action heroes, like that was the first
one.
Yeah,
In Search of the Last Action Heroes.
Right. That was the first. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. And then In Search of Darkness was up for like either a Kickstarter or whatever. And I'm like, oh, I'm on this. And I told everyone I knew about it. And then since then, everything you guys have put out, I've backed immediately.
You praise you and thank you for allowing me to be here on like my sixth documentary, because it's fans like you and backers like you and people who love this stuff so much. We'll get into it obviously,
yeah.
But you know, these are crowdfunded documentaries that I make, so it's super cool that your passion and involvement allows me to have like the greatest job in the world.
Yeah. And the thing is this, and this is one of the things we talk about a lot, is that obviously we are horror fans. You know, we grew up and cut our teeth on horror and stuff like that. Obviously my brother and I grew up together. We're having a lot of shared experiences and stuff like that. And Chris is a little older than Luke and I, but again, also a Northern, so a New York kind of thing. And our friend Hero, Chris Tyler, he's from Boston. So our experiences often are very similar. So it's always nice to have someone on who has maybe a different, you know, didn't grow up with us, obviously, but like a different experience of what's there, but also sharing that same thing. And that's one of the things we found when we talk horror, is that it's amazing, even the, and I don't know how to say this, well, just to say it, I guess, like the things that connect you with horror. And even though like my favorite movie might not be your favorite movie, might not be Chris's favorite movie or Luke's, like I can see the value in what's there. And even if we disagree, it's not a blow up end of the world kind of disagreement. It's a, okay, you like what you like, I like what I like. And it's rare nowadays, I should say, that sometimes you can have a disagreement about what we like on film. It might not be the same as everybody else. I think one of the nice things about horror fans is that because for a long time, we've been the redheaded stepchild, you know, kind of thing that's been pushed aside, that we kind of like, well, you know, we kind of more accepting, and you know, that we, again, if you love, you know, bloods and boobs and all that stuff, awesome. If you are much more a slow burn, awesome. It's all your kind of thing, you know. And that's one of the nice things about horror, is that it allows so many different things to come together under that heading. So, you know,
absolutely. Well, first of all, Chris, which part of New York did you grow? Are you in, or did you grow up in?
Northern New York, up near Watertown. I'm in Rochester now.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. I grew up in Westchester, just outside of New York City, but better. I also went.
That's where we're from. We're from Brewster.
Brewster.
Putnam County. Yeah.
In Putnam. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're so cool, Brewster. But we, I went to Ithaca College in central New York as well. So
I've spent a lot of time in Ithaca.
Born and raised in an East Coaster by Midwestern parents, and I've been ever since I graduated Ithaca Film School. I've been in California, so I kind of straddle all over the place. But without further ado, I do have to say that you're absolutely right. I think horror fans really have sort of this this sort of secret handshake of, yeah, we all understand that everything isn't great. In fact, we all understand that a lot of these movies are terrible, but that's the appeal. And that's what we bond and connect over. And, you know, I think it's very important to say when it comes to a lot of these horror movies, especially within this genre, and with the documentaries that I make, and I can kind of describe all that stuff, you know, shortly, but ultimately everything's on an even playing field as far as I'm concerned, the way I portray them in these In Search of Darkness documentaries that survey an entire decade. Because if you start saying this is good and this is bad and this is more important and that's less important, it's irrelevant, because what these movies are really about is about your personal connection to it. Mm-hmm. And your personal connection might not be just about what the movie is about, but who you were with, where you were, how old you were, whether you should have been seeing it or not. all these experiences about, when you first saw these things, and usually most of us saw these movies a little too early before we were ready. And it imprinted like a baby to its mother in our brains, you know? And so I absolutely agree. You know, there's more to it than that meets the eye, especially to the outsider.
Yeah. And it's funny that that Jay, you mentioned that, and David, you expounded on that, because where the film that we're, or the next project that you're talking about, the back half of the 90s, right, 1995 through 1999, is such a transitional period for the genre on film. But I was saying this to my wife as we were prepping this, is that it's like you have like this neat divide, in the second year of this, and then you can say, well, this is kind of before that and this is kind of after that, but it all still plays together, right? It all still gets along. What's funny to me is that after this, we would start to see like some of those territorial things, right, where you'd have, well, you know, torture porn is not real horror, right? It's not real serious stuff like this Japanese horror, right? And then the torture porn fans would be like, your Japanese horror stuff is just a bunch of stupid ghost stories. No one cares. That's boring, right? Whereas here in the 90s, we all still were like, I could say the secret handshake, right? It's like we were the same ones reading Ciné Fantastique and Fangoria. We kind of knew the lay of the land, right? It's like, oh, there's a new movie coming out direct to video, because I'm the guy going to Blockbuster or Hollywood Video or Movies, if you lived in Clemson, South Carolina, like I did at the time, to go rent, you know, Pinocchio's Revenge or whatever, and you know, not necessarily to go get the A-list movie. Yeah. But it's, you know, that's the thing that, and my brother and I, it's funny because I've seen all the previous In Search of Darkness, but we watched, we watched one when we were together, Jay, while we were in Manhattan.
We were going through STEM. So that was, I think it was two. It might've been two. It might've been two. I'm trying to remember.
I think it was the second one, but it's one of those things that, you know, you try to explain the concept of the In Search of, and it's like, well, it's like having a conversation with another fan or a family friend or whomever who's into the same stuff. And it's like, you don't have to, it's not telling one big story. It's telling a bunch of little stories, and it's kind of transitions like, oh, we're going to talk about Motel Hell, and now we're going to talk about the cat people. And now we're going to talk about Halloween 6, and now we're going to talk about the faculty or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's that kind of free flowing nature of it, because we're all into the same things, like you said, right. Yeah. We all have similar, as soon as they said, oh, it's the back half of the 90s. It's like, well, I graduated high school in 1998. right? So it's like you said, probably too early for some of this, but it's right in that sweet spot of being the late teens, early 20s, you know, video and DVD are at the boom, right? As far as there's still that market. We get the resurgence of horror in Hollywood because it takes a different kind of tact than it did in the 80s and early 90s. So it's fascinating stuff. And like I said, it's that we can all talk about it kind of on a, like I said, a level playing field and not worry about this is attractive, that is not, right? That's yeah. the thing that I like about these movies, because like you say, Chris and Jay will tell you, I'm a huge fan of like direct to video and like Full Moon, like Charlie Band's output and stuff from the 80s and 90s. And I recognize most of it is hot garbage, right? but it's fun hot garbage, right? I knew if it's like, oh sweet, Puppet Master 4 is on
Who
HBO.
Wants cold garbage when you can have hot
right. It is a mess that heat has been applied to, right? It's makes it all the better. But it's yeah, so it's that it's that's the wonderful thing about this time period. Like I said, it's so transitional and it covers so many different bases, right? Going because I just went through and just pulled, I said this to the guys before we got on. I said I'm just gonna look through a list of movies and pull some and kind of throw them into like general categories. And there's some big categories that kind of break out, and we'll talk about them as we go on here. But I love that we're not a lot of times we get to it's like, well, horror movies stopped being cool in 1989. And it's like, no, there's lots of great stuff out here, guys. You just got to have an open mind.
I think what's interesting about the 90s collectively, the entire decade, is that, when we were moving from the 80s to the 90s, there's a contingent who weren't sort of coming up on those movies. And they were a little older. And they're just like, yeah, the 90s collectively was hot garbage. You know, they are,
right.
Or they're like, well, gosh, I'm hard pressed to see what was important in the 90s. You know, there was like Scream, and you know, people kind of memory hold it a little bit. And so I kind of made it my mission. Whereas the 80s was kind of like, that was easy. That was mm-hmm. an easy sell,
right?
Because so many people love it, know it. Listen, we all know it's not perfect, but when you look at that decade, it really stole the spotlight. But the 90s, I think I had to remind people, especially with part one, with 90 to 94, that there was so much cool, good stuff. Not
right.
only the sort of select titles like Bram Stoker's Dracula or Silence of the Lambs, and even having to qualify Silence of the Lambs, whether or not that's horror or not, and versus thriller, that kind of stuff like that. But when you get to the second half of the 90s, there's still kind of on the flip side, you're still trying to have to, you being me, having to sort of explain, well, you know, it wasn't only Scream. Scream
right.
you know, stole the spotlight, or it wasn't only, you know, Blair Witch or Sixth mm-hmm. Sense. There's still a huge, 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 just broad spectrum of amazing creative filmmaking, from studio releases to backyard barbecue, you know, made in the weekend movies, shot on video.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's so much going on, and it's a great story to tell, and it makes me happy to be able to curate a lot of these amazing titles where people are just like, wait, that came out? Or I never heard of that one, you know?
Yeah.
Or revisit something that they kind of dismissed. And I think we're all like that at a certain point. We all kind of turned our nose up at certain titles where you 30 years later, you have a whole different perspective, you know, or 30 plus years later,
right?
Where you're like, well, listen, you know, now that's sort of an era that I kind of appreciate more. Gosh, that was sort of a balance between, you know, practical effects and, mm-hmm. you know, burgeoning CGI.
Yeah.
Look what they did here. Like, or I never knew about Necronomicon, that Brian Yuzna directed that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's a good
love
one.
That movie.
You know,
yeah.
Jeffrey Combs is H.P. Lovecraft. How come no one talks about that? So there are things that still are worthy of discovery. And I'm excited to share that in this next installment.
I think these documentaries and your documentaries and other documentaries for similar style, they're basically with the younger kids now, they're going to end up being the equivalent of reading like Fangoria and Starlog and Famous Monsters and all that, and the Psychotronic Guide to Film and those types of books. That, I mean, basically people don't consume magazines, or, you know, they're there, but they're just a pricey little novelty for people who are old enough to remember them.
Yeah,
but people consume You know, and these, and you give them a three and a half hour documentary, and they're just like, they're ready for it, and they'll sit there, and that's going to be their entry point into go taking, not just watching horror movies, but getting into the whole history and all that. So that's how they feel when I watch these documentaries. They're just, it's a subject I know about, but at the same time, I'm always going to pick up something I hadn't heard of, and like I'm scribbling down on a piece of paper, and like we're going to look up this one, and that's what I love. I mean, I think they're still printing Psychotronic, but I'm not
Oh, I don't
sure.
know.
No,
I don't know.
no, or the.
Hold on to your copies if your
I
dog needs a
know.
copy.
Oh yeah,
But
I have a horror stories about that myself, but
well, I think a lot of people watch these documentaries. As I continue to make these documentaries over and over and over, I think they reinforce a lot of things for different things for different people. But I believe there's a huge contingent that just watches them with their letterboxed, open so they could like curate a list for themselves and like more for my, more for my list, and then I've discovered also there are some people who like, listen, I think we all can agree, myself first and foremost, that a 4 hour, 5 hour, 6 hour documentary is not for everybody. But I found that, or at least not for repeat viewing after you've sort of tasted it and you're like, okay, now I've seen it. I don't have to do that again, But I found people like to come back to these documentaries over and over and over and over to the point where it's this weird comfort blanket. And when I say weird, it's not a negative thing. It's more weird for me because I never planned it that way, but people love to put it on in the background. They love to put it on. Everything from ideas for their playlist to just like having like-minded people talk about and celebrate the stuff that you loved and meant so much to you. And while on one hand, discovering brand new stuff, you get to revisit the stuff that you love, and just seeing all the clips, seeing people love how talk about how much they love about it. This whole experience sort of washes over you. This sort of nostalgic bliss. And I never quite expected the repeat viewing that people get where they, when every time, the reason why they're all long is because people say over and over and over, this was great. I wish it was longer. And I'm like, really? So, okay,
Well,
you know, twist my arm.
then,
As a
and the and
podcaster, I've noticed that people that listen to our podcast, there'll be people who are sitting down and listening to podcasts I made 8, 10 years ago. They're like, oh, I'm going through them, and we were making 3 hour podcasts. Like it was during that 2008 recession, and Scott Gardner was out of a job, and we had a lot of time to podcast. And people listen to it going to bed, going to sleep, and stuff like that, to the point of where it's almost scary for me, because it's just like these people like know things about me that I didn't even know that I was talking about, or remember things I said that I forgot like 10
I'm more
minutes after I
concerned for
said
the
them.
listeners falling asleep to you. That's the part that's kind of upsetting and scary, really.
That could be Dario right now. He could be tucked into bed right now with his headphones on, listening to
I still
this.
regret saying my social security number on the podcast.
So one
Well,
of the
and the thing also, but with the format alone, right? It is because it's not one. It's not a documentary that has like one through line, right? One of my favorite documentary films of all time is a film called by a filmmaker called Alan Berliner called The Sweetest Sound, and it's about names, right? And it's a great film if you ever get a chance to watch it. But that's it. It's like a tight like 85 minutes, and it has a through line, right? Because it's not talking, it goes to different topics. But here, this is almost episodic, right? It's like, all right, I'm going to watch one more segment, and then this time I mean it, I'm going to bed, right? But it's because I have to work in the morning. So that makes it's like I said, you say people have it on in the background or when they're getting ideas. It's like when my brother and I were watching, I said he we were up in the city because my brother was getting treatment, right, for getting cancer treatment. And so it's like we're home from treatment, and it's like, okay, well, we're back at the apartment for treatment. It's like, well, let's just put this on while we're making dinner, and then we'll eat dinner, and then we'll do this, and like, and then okay, then we'll do something else later, or we'll just go to bed after we watch, you know, again, Motel Hell or whatever the segment is, right? So that makes it very palatable and very easy to get into and digest. You look at it, you're like, cheese and rice, 4.5 hours. You're like, well, it's a bunch of movies. Well, it'll be fine.
real quick, one of the things that I really love about being able to make these documentaries is those chapters in between.
Yeah.
Because that provides context. Mm. So initially, yes, you know, if you have just like a laundry list of movie after movie after movie after movie, you know, you have to take it piecemeal. But these the way for anyone who doesn't know, and I'm sure there are plenty, these documentaries go from they cover a whole decade. So 1980 to 1989, each year you have about, you know, 10, 12, 15 movies that you have, you know, segments that are just a few minutes, and then you move on to the next big poster wall, pick another poster, you're in that movie. But in between each year, you have these larger context chapters, you know, whether you're setting the stage for the whole era, or you're talking about this special effects, you're talking about the music, you're talking about all these different things. But those are very important to me to take this big jigsaw puzzle of a decade and create context, and also connect it to the zeitgeist of the times, whether it's pop culture, whether it's socio-political, whether it's the psychology of a culture or the politics of a culture. Horror movies are always in reaction to those, either intentionally or subliminally. And you can connect it that way as well, either very literally or more figuratively. And so that's kind of what's fun, at least to give a little more dimension to these documentaries rather than people who might think that they're just the world's largest listicle.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, which arguably they are too.
Well, but that's one thing I was going to say. The three from the 80s, you know, obviously you went from 80 to 89, then 80 to 89, then 80 to 89, all three of them covering different movies kind of thing, different, not obviously the same movies kind of thing. Whereas the 90s was covering just the first half, which as I'd always said to Luke when the third one came out, because you guys put out a list and it was all the movies that had ever been there, and it said, how many had you seen? It was whatever. And I went through and I had seen all of them. Every movie on the list I had seen. And my buddy Damien goes, dude, I'm only missing four. And I said, okay, catch up, because it was just a thing, right? And like, there was movies by the time we get to the third documentary, now we're getting to the, you know, the straight to video, the whatever, the stuff that was so much more obscure. And I was like, wait, have I seen that? And I'm like, I have seen that. And it was like going back to those memories that I did, you know, it hadn't had. But when we got to the 90s, and then you start now we're only doing half the decade, but we're going to go more in depth in each of those years. Now it's like, oh my God, you were taking me, this is eighth grade. Like, this is like, I mean, it's what it is. It's so funny because we connect so many things, so many memories we have, you know, you don't think at the time you're making a memory. It's just part of just you living your life. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the idea that at the age of, so you were four, I was six. We're watching The Exorcist with my dad, you know, no big deal. Right.
Yeah.
You're making core memories. Like I'm not, you know, it's one of those things you start connecting those things and they come back to you. And each time you watch one of those segments, but especially during the 80s one, and this is something that I think when I first said to people, I said, it's a bunch of movies. They're like, I don't want to just listen. I go, it's not just, this is a really good movie and this is a good movie. Like, it's people who worked on them, people who were involved, all the stuff that goes there. Then it was about the soundtracks, the art, the whatever, like all the things that, even if you don't think that those are influential, if you're of a certain age, the video store wall of covers was so important. And for you guys to have the posters like that, and it goes and it just zooms in on one of them, I'm like, because like, you know, it kind of goes wide and you start coming in, you're like, oh, is it going to the thing? Oh, it's going there. It's like, you know, like
my friends and I rented Reanimator by walking into the video store. Poster, you know,
one of the formats we do on this show that we've been running cheese and rice probably for about 6-7 years now is called Horror Rack Hanger On, where it's just any movie that was released on VHS that I remember seeing at the horror aisle at the video store,
which used to be a gas station,
for us
this is how old this is.
Well, Yeah, well, it used to be a gas station, and then we had the IGA, remember? Had
Yes.
the IGA had the one, had the little video section, and then
That
we actually did get the little video place next to the pizzeria, right?
was
And then there was the other one by the barber shop.
yeah.
So, but in any event, yeah, I mean that's like you say, it is that it's all that sense memory and the
Well,
shared
yeah,
memories, right?
it used to be a means to an end, and I don't think many of us, definitely speaking for myself, I enjoyed the experience. I wanted to go and see what I could find and discover. I enjoyed going through the art, but I did not value it. It was infinitesimally, I can't say it,
Very
valued in
small.
comparison. Yeah, in comparison, infinitesimal. I'm going to stop myself now. But anyway,
Much
in
smaller.
compare, in com much smaller, infinitesimal, right?
There you
And then
go.
the infinitesimally.
Infinitesimal,
But the memory just it's so funny because our world and our culture has evolved where we can't go through the records at the record store as easily as we used to. We can't go through the videos, look at them, fly, flip to the back. Sometimes these video stores where you're like, oh, they've got it, and then you pick it up and it's empty because someone, rented it, and you're just like, oh, brutal, And listen, there's a whole operation that we all did where you're like, okay, I'm getting the one that has this clearly way too much TNA. Okay, I got to stack it under Bambi and over Megaforce,
It was when
and hopefully the cute girl who's checking people out won't ask me anything about it.
Hey, there's a reason why Puppet Master 3 was one of the, it was on my rotation for years and years and years in high school, is because that's got some of the best DNA of any movie I had ever seen at that point. Oh my goodness gracious. It's funny also talking about, with memory and stuff, right? Because going through, I said, I just really basic, just went through, Wikipedia, horror movies released 95, 96, 97, went through it and just writing these things down. And it's like, oh man, you had said there's so many movies that people either neglected or overlooked or just forgot about, right? And even ones that I liked, I'm like, oh my gosh, that did come out in 1997. Or, the ones that really, it was funny because they kind of stood out when I was going through and just from memory is, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier, Halloween 6, Halloween the Curse of Michael Myers, right? Came out in 1995. And I remember very distinctly not seeing it when it came out because I never really was able, I mean, I was 14, 15, right? But I remember seeing it when it came on HBO. And for some reason, we didn't have school that day, but I had to go in the afternoon, like we had football practice or something. I remember being home alone and watching that and being like, man, this is pretty cool. And I was a huge Halloween fan because growing up in New York, Halloween and Halloween 2 were always on Channel 11, and Halloween 4 was on HBO constantly. But so that's like the fall. I want to say that's like the fall of 96. And then, like, my brother had just gone to school, right? And
He's
so
up in
my brother
Albany.
was 2 hours away. And so, but I remember that my brother came home that winter and we went and saw Scream at the theater at like a 11 o'clock showing where the guys smuggled the beer in. You hear, oh shit, I dropped my beer.
He dropped not a can of beer, a bottle of beer, and it shatters. And the whole
Oh.
thing now smells of cheap beer because that just
Smells
made it
like beer.
better. And
And
I
that's when you just
remember.
had the slopes. You hoped it wasn't behind you because
No,
you
he was
had
in front of us.
Yeah, it was in front of us. Yeah. But I just
That's why the
remember
floors
it's
are
one of
sticky,
those,
partially.
but it was one of those things, right? That I just remember thinking, and it's stupid because I'm like 15, 16. I'm like, shit, that just raised the bar, right? Movies like Halloween 6 ain't gonna cut it anymore after this, right? So we're in for a golden age that's never gonna end. And
Well,
the
in all fairness, I'll be very honest, is that and I'm obviously we're you're gonna talk about this in the documentary. Scream is such a tentpole of horror in the night. Like it's everyone knows Scream. Even if you don't like horror, my wife
if you don't
doesn't like horror
know
movies,
it, you know
knows
it, yeah.
Scream, right? She knows Scream. But Scream was not a hit when it first came out. And then it kind of was nothing. And then they re-released it and it became hot. Like I literally remember sitting on a so I did Division One track at Albany. So we're on these coach buses with these thing, and someone got a copy of Scream, And I was like, hey, so I go, I want to see it. And everyone's like, that's a horror movie. I go, yeah, but it's like red hot right now because it was nothing and it got hot. We watched it on the bus and I am on a bus full of, oh, I don't know, 100 people. None of them are horror fans but me. No one likes horror in this whole bus. They were enthralled. They were like, oh my God, this is so good. And I'm like, yeah, this is pretty good.
Wes Craven knows how to work a mass audience when he has to.
I need to write this down. What's the name of this movie?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll put it in the
document. Never heard of it. And who is this guy? Wes Craven? Never heard of him. But it's so funny,
just
though.
An indie guy.
Right. Because yeah. You think back to like some, maybe he's okay. You know, what Wes Craven was able to do with like Nightmare on Elm Street, right? Kind of thing where he created this, you know, the beginnings of what became, I mean, Freddy, who would have ever figured that Freddy Krueger becomes Freddy Krueger? You know what I'm saying? Let alone what we've able to, you know, now, I mean, and this might sound blasphemous to some people, but without Freddy Krueger, do we really ever get Chucky the way Chucky is? Like, could he ever be as wise? Because the original Child's Play is not the same as the way Chucky is now. Chucky now is completely different. Right?
Well, Freddy evolved too. Freddy was not the quippy guy until later.
Yeah. Well,
and that's the other thing, right? Is that Scream forced the other franchises to play catch up.
Yep.
Because I talked about Halloween 6. Well, what comes after Halloween 6 is H2O, mm-hmm. right? H2O is so in the wake of Scream.
It's the Screamification of Halloween.
100%. Exactly.
To the point where Kevin Williamson wrote a treatment and they basically wrote a script based on his treatment.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the crazy part is that, so you had these franchises that had done what they had done. And, you know, as a guy with Jason Voorhees tattooed on his arm and Carrie White tattooed on his leg, like I wear my affiliation to the old school on my body. It's there for everyone to see. But what happened as you look at where Friday the 13th, they were just churning them out and they were making money hand over fist, but they had to step up what's happening because you couldn't just make the exact same cookie cutter movie anymore. Right. And then you wind up having, New Nightmare, which is just so revolutionary compared to what we had from the Nightmare. And I love the Nightmare movies. I love the Nightmare movies. I have the box set coming. It's in the mail to me right now. Watch them 4K. Right.
I mean, I think Scream sort of kicked off that sort of like meta movie is self-evaluation or, you know, genre evaluation sort of thing. And it just became, you know, Wes Craven was pretty good at starting off, you know, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre really spawned a whole slew of to this day, you know.
If you look at New Nightmare, it's kind of like it's sort of the training ground for Scream in many ways in terms of meta.
Yeah.
And you can even look at People Under the Stairs.
Yep.
As bringing, you know, I remember I was like, People Under the Stairs, that looks scary and I'm going to stay away. And I saw it and I was like, this is the most entertaining, ridiculous, you know.
That and Deadly Friend were just sort of that slipped under the radar that were really fun.
And we covered on this show, we covered Shocker.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like, you know, our consensus was that the character gets a concussion right at football practice at the beginning, and the rest of it he's having brain trauma, and that's what the movie is as he gets progressively worse because he didn't go into the protocol. But it's, you know, but again, you talk about mass, you know, appealing to the mass market and you know, just being you know, fun and entertaining. That was one of the other things I made on my notes here is that for a while in the 80s, right, girls would go to horror movies like on dates, but girls didn't like horror, air quotes up to the mic, right? Girls didn't like horror because it became such a geek show. That was at least the general consensus. I remember going to see I Know What You Did Last Summer on a date when I was in high school because my girlfriend wanted to go see it.
Right.
Right. Yep. Scream made it okay for girls to like horror again and because
they
it could
also
be
had sort of teen beat actor, you know, actors.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
Sort of the teen
WB style.
They're all hot passing. And they're going to be picked off.
Yeah.
Everybody wins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, because that was what we called, that was the, at the time, the term meta wasn't, at least it wasn't used in our circle. We called it the teen bopper.
We didn't use that until then. Yeah.
Yeah.
We called them the teeny bopper movies because they had all the teenage cast, right? So it was Scream and I Know What You Did Last Summer and Urban Legend and The Faculty and Halloween H2O and, you know, all these and types of movies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they'd also cast all these people who were like from Dawson's Creek and Party of Five. You know, it was basically the Melrose Place slash 90210 of horror. Just get a hot cast, put them together. I mean, it's Friends, really? You know, it's like,
yeah, we got, that's right.
You know, Monica from Friends, she's still alive. I mean,
And the thing is,
just as an aside, as an old time wrestler, as a wrestling fan, I do love that, you know, Monica and, David Arquette both make it out of those movies, right? Former or future WCW World Heavyweight Champion, David Arquette.
Yeah. Well, if you stayed with a spoiler alert, one of them kind of gets it in these more recent movies, but I won't say anything,
but I think they're past three
managing to bring them back anyway. You know, I mean, hey, they brought back Jamie Kennedy in Scream 3. They were clever the way they did that.
Yes.
So one of the things, as Luke would say, like, again, and as influential as Scream is, but there's literally, I one of my absolute favorite movies of this time period is From Dusk Till Dawn, which is just absolutely like, that is such a feel-good movie that shouldn't be a feel-good movie. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't watch, if you're in a bad mood and you watch From Dusk Till Dawn, you'll be in a good mood at the end. Just Cheech Marin alone gets you in a great mood. But the idea is,
we say that way too often on this show. But you can find true. Better parts.
But the thing is, like, a movie like that is so different than what Scream would be and what the kind of other side thing. But yet, you know how many people would say, oh my, I forgot about that movie. That movie is funny because they may not remember the George Clooney, and Quentin Tarantino killing everybody, kind of getting there, but they remember that when it goes absolutely apeshit in the piece, right? But that kind of stuff, those kind of movies, nowadays, first, they don't make movies like that anymore. But if they did, it would be like, wow, have you seen this? Like, it's such, because it just,
well,
it's infectious.
Except for Sinners.
That's the thing, yeah. So Sinners
is not the same movie, though.
But Sinners is the same structure.
It
and
takes
so,
the same turn.
So,
yeah.
But you know, just to make an analogy, you know, if there were people when Dusk Till Dawn came out, there were people who actually, they thought it was like a Tarantino gangster.
Yes. Right.
Most people knew, and especially when you saw the trailer, there's no way around it, you know, that it's a, you know, spoiler alert, it's a nest of vampires.
Yeah.
And they got it's Assault on Precinct 13, in the titty twister. But I don't know if I could say that. But
oh,
they
said
it in the movie.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
But Sinners is the same way. There were people who just did not know, you know? So they're just like, what? This is a vampire movie? I didn't know that, you know? Well, and it's great because being able to preserve the twist that, you know, where you haven't seen the trailer, I will make a quick blanket statement that having used to be in entertainment journalism, you know, I was at Entertainment Tonight. I was Famous Monsters, other stuff. I basically had to just spoil everything for myself. Because I had to write about the trailer for the trailer for the teaser for the trailer before the trailer would come out.
Right.
And by the time the movie came out, I knew everything about it. And by the time I saw it, because I wanted to see it, there were few surprises, especially these days with trailers. You know, what I do now is I already know if I'm going to see the movie. I already know I want to see the movie. And I take absolute pride in not watching any of the trailer whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Not reading anything about it.
As much as I'm tempted.
Yeah.
And then, so when I see these movies, it's incredibly organic as it unfolds. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying, well, that's cool, but I know this is going to happen or that's going to happen. And it's a refreshing way to watch movies. If you're able to, you know, be, you know, have the control, self-control.
From Dusk Till Dawn was one of my, in the cinema religious experiences. This only happened like two or three times at this job. I worked there for like almost 15 years, but it was at a Mexican restaurant, and all the employees were like, tonight after this shift, let's go to a midnight movie. And we were like, who gets to pick out the movie? And they picked this one waitress, the waitress I had the crush on. And at this time Quentin Tarantino was huge. And she goes, there's a movie called From Dusk Till Dawn that Quentin Tarantino did. And we're like, there's a new Quentin Tarantino movie? Nobody had seen a trailer, anything. And
Perfect.
then we're like, okay, we'll go to see that. We all like Quentin Tarantino. And we all pile in. It was a packed theater too. And we piled in. And as we were going in, I'm looking at the movie poster and I see Robert Rodriguez on there. And I go, ooh, okay. And I'm like, this is gonna be something else. And like, this waitress was psyched, sat right next to me. We're watching the movie. Everybody's like, okay, this is a solid Quentin Tarantino movie. It's got George Clooney acting, and it's dark, but the dialogue's, and then it's vampires. And I look over at this girl and she's ashen white. She's like, I hate vampires. And the rest of the movie was us feeding off her, just like hiding behind her hands. And it
Awesome.
was,
Oh my
and the audience
goodness.
was
That's
going,
perfect because she kept on grabbing your arm.
the audience is going nuts. It was just one of those perfect, experiences at a movie.
That is
I think in the
fantastic.
last interview we talked about the same sort of thing where we went blindly into Big Trouble in Little China at the Cineplex.
I have
I'm like,
the
we're
in
going to
I
see
have
this. It's John Carpenter.
yeah
It's gonna be good. And they're like, I don't know. This sounds stupid. And I became the hero of the night that night.
Yeah, so good. I was gonna say I have a sort of the inverse experience. I went to go see E.T. opening weekend when I was young, and I knew nothing other than it's a new Steven Spielberg movie. And so I remember, if we all remember, in the opening of E.T., there, when you first see E.T. kind of walking from afar, a distance in the woods, he's this weird waddling barrel-shaped creature, and there's this moment of like, uh-oh, is this like Steven Spielberg stumbling? What are we watching here? And I remember these two girls who were sitting right in front of me. They started whispering to each other, like, "God, I told you, this sucks. This totally sucks. I told you we should have seen Dawn of the Dead." And at this multiplex, and Dawn of the Dead was back out. And they're like, "Just forget it, forget it. We'll just watch it," you know. And I remember, I cannot. It's indelible. These girls were bawling their eyes out when E.T. as we all
Oh my
were.
God,
Yeah,
yeah.
we
I
all
remember.
were thinking of just like, and they wanted to ditch this for Dawn of the Dead, and now they're crying and totally invested.
In all
So
fairness, though, seeing
I've got
Dawn of
a
the Dead in the
tape.
theater would have been really cool too. But it's not quite the same. It's not quite the same experience as seeing E.T.
I've got two cassette tapes of my friend Scott Gardner and I when we were I can't remember how old we were. It was probably about 12 when E.T. came out, and we snuck in a tape recorder and a packed matinee of E.T. full of kids and taped the whole movie so we could listen to it
Oh,
afterwards.
yeah.
And it is just amazing to hear like a movie cry. They're just being played like a fiddle through the whole thing.
And those are great too, because I used to do that with, like, Star Wars and Close Encounters, especially when these are back in the days when you didn't have
Just
instant
listen to the
gratification.
tapes.
And so there's always a, it's not as long as the movie, so you only get so much. But also there's that pivotal moment where it stops. And then there's the switch over, and you missed whatever the window.
We
Did
were a
someone
team.
stumbling in a dump have to turn the tape over and put it
I had
down?
spare tapes pre-labeled in my pocket, and Scott
Wow,
was
you
locked.
were prepared. You were armed. You were locked and
Oh,
loaded.
It was all Scott. He did the organizing, and he's like, "Here's what we're
Wow.
gonna do: fresh batteries, and
It's like, here's what we need. We need three camcorders. I'm going to need two guys on the side and one in the middle.
Guys, way more organized than I was. Way more
We were
organized.
messing around. We were going to spend a lot of time listening. We listened to E.T. dozens of times. He taped, audio taped the Superman the movie when they had the extra scenes so we could hear all the extra scenes. I have a lot of movies memorized, the audio part, every sound
Right,
effect
because
and
you
music.
listen to it over and over and
You listen
over.
to it,
So
it's Yeah, I mean, you talk about, again, we talked so about like the sequels and the franchises and stuff, but you know, Jay, you mentioning From Dusk Till Dawn, and David, you had said this too. There's a lot of really good original stuff from the back half
Oh,
of the
yeah.
90s, and some things that you just don't think of. And a couple that jumped out to me, one movie especially, which when I was going through here, there was a few, but one that jumped out to me personally. And you talked about this also, like the mix of the physical and the digital effects was Wishmaster, which is another movie
Oh
we
yeah. Oh
covered on
yeah.
this. And I am a huge fan of that because to me that's like the upstart. That's the ones like they want to be a franchise. You can tell right from the start. It's like, yes, we want to be a franchise, but we're going to do things a little bit different. We got this new technology we can use, and
I've
they
already
have
got a
the call.
treatment for Wishmaster too, you
Yeah.
know.
Yep, I tell
Ready
you
to
what,
go.
I have a treatment for a Wishmaster movie, because if you'll remember that film, the protagonist, she works at an auction house, right? And that's
Right,
her
right,
role, and
right.
that's how they bring the character in, is that they found this giant artifact that they're going to auction. I would have the protagonist be an attorney and have to be very precise about how they say their words to trick the Jin, right? Because it's like,
Right?
oh, well, you said at this time that you were going to do this, right? It's like, well, that's not what I meant at all, but you know, that kind of thing.
Remake
He
of The
didn't
Devil and
mention in
Daniel Webster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
What
like,
the
I will
well
remind you, sir, that we are in the
Well,
Commonwealth of Virginia.
happy to
But it.
say I have the Wishmaster himself, Andrew Devoff,
Oh, awesome.
talking all about Wishmaster and Robert Kurtzman as well. And
Oh, yes.
Robert Kurtzman, he was the guy who came up with the story for From Dusk Till Dawn, and then he directed Wishmaster. And he came up with the story, and he was going to direct it himself, but then it became a bigger thing after they brought on this unknown writer, Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Some
then,
hack.
you know,
Yeah.
then
There's a bunch
yeah,
of feet
something
involved. I
happened.
don't know.
Something fictitious happened. But anyway, it's very cool to be able to, you know, for those who again might not know these documentaries so well, you did mention a lot of the people who work on these movies. It's really fun for me to sit across from them and pick their brains and get these stories, and get sort of new angles and new wrinkles and new tales as well. But it's also kind of a time capsule of this era as they talk about, you know, their triumphs and their challenges making these movies. And then just, you know, the fact that they get to talk about these movies 30 plus years later, they're more often than not, they're like, ah, gosh, I was just, you know, gonna jump to the next, and I didn't think this would have the legs that it does. So, but yeah, they were brand new. Everyone was trying to make a brand new villain that would be able to, you know, launch a franchise, and that was definitely the intention with Wishmaster. And
Yeah,
then
the other one, like that, just real quick, Jane, I'll let this, what that I remember similar is Prophecy with Christopher Walken, right? Which is
Prophecy.
another good one from that era, right? But yeah, and that's, you know, and it's, you know, we're, and that was in addition to Scream, right? We're always just kind of finding that new thing, right? Because the other big one that I again had, and I remember liking, and I remember going to see it because I saw it with my brother and several other people, right? And we did mention it was Blair Witch,
Oh my God.
right? And that was such, it's hard to explain that movie now. My oldest is 17, and she is a burgeoning horror fan. Okay, so we've watched, you know, like I think like her favorite movie may be Happy Death Day. Like I know your daughter loves
My
Happy
daughter
Death
loves
Day, Jay.
the
Yeah. So, but she loves that. Like she watched Final Destination. She's watched, you know, we watched Nightmare on Elm Street a few weeks back. And I, you know, and it's hard for me. It's like, 'cause I want her to see these classics. Like, how do you explain Blair
You
Witch
can't.
now? Right? Because they debunk it in like 10 minutes now. Right? But back then it's like, well, this could be real, guys. I don't know yet.
The crazy part about Blair Witch, and obviously, you know, we all lived through this, was that it was just something that, like, it was too early for the internet to ruin, but it was late enough where you're like, this could, like you're just not sure enough.
No, the
It was
internet
at the
enhanced
exact
it.
right time.
Yeah, it
The
was
exact right time.
the internet actually helped it.
Yes,
Yeah,
exactly.
it fueled
Between
the
the
mystery
website on
of
the
it feeling
internet
real
and the
or not.
TV documentary that they put out before it that I didn't see till after I saw the movie.
And it was on the Sci-Fi Channel, The Curse of what the Blair Witch or whatever they called it, right?
But
That
yeah, and
documentary did wonders for making everyone like, oh, so in all fairness, like we went, like my brother, I was my brother, our friend Bob, and my girlfriend at the time, who is now not my wife, is a different woman. You know, kind of thing. Well, we don't talk about that. Anyway, so the thing is, she wasn't a horror fan at all, but like the movie sucked her in. And it's so crazy that because she bought Hook, Line, and Sinker, and she, like, a lot of people jumped up at the end, like, what? And it was so funny because when it came out on VHS, I mean, at that point, people already talked about Blair Witch, whatever. When I got my hands on a VHS, because there was no DVD yet, my friend Flavia, who was another shot putter, and then we had our friend Pedro, who was a sprinter. We're sitting in our dorm room watching this, and Flav had seen it, and I had seen it. We got to the end, and literally when it cut, Pedro jumped up and goes, what the hell? And he starts screaming. He goes, what happened to them? And I go, Pedro, this is fake. He goes, no, don't look at those people.
These poor people.
No, because they don't look like actors. They look like regular people because we had had enough of the Jennifer Love Hewitts and the, you know, the very
poor people. So this is sort of the antithesis of that.
Right. That's how you sell it.
Someone who is just a film student, just a few years, like 3 years before Blair Witch came out. All those characters tracked all the way that they were handling that documentary as film students. It played perfectly. Yeah. It was perfectly presented, you know. Yeah. And
that ultimately was kind of the answer to the sort of fatigue that people got with everything that was meta, because in a very short order, in the second half of the 90s, basically once Scream really exploded, and then I Know What You Did Last Summer kind of cemented that for Kevin Williamson. Everyone wanted to make a teen-driven horror piece. And so you got your urban legends and you got everything else that had sort of followed with that. But ultimately, I think it became so mainstream that the horror fans, they turned to things like Blair Witch. Yep. They turned to things like the J-horror stuff. Mm-hmm. They ultimately, when it got to the point where everything was just a joke and you got the Scary Movie franchise where everyone could just laugh at all these characters and all these things, that's when Hostel and Saw and Rob Zombie's take on things, you know, really, really, really hardcore in your face stuff. The pendulum swung.
I think it was actually Seven that sort of like started that. And horror movies were like, oh, wait, we want, instead of being like funny entertainment, maybe we should be trying to either horrify or just completely disturb.
Yep. And Seven also was important, Chris, because what I think Seven did was it was like that realization that, hey, we can get away with more with the MPAA than we used to be able to. Because Seven being a mainstream movie with like actual actors, like people you've heard of that is doing this stuff. It's like, if they can do it, now we can point to that as a precedent and say, hey, you let them do this in Seven, we can do this. Right. And I said the exact same thing to my wife, because I was going through this list, and I said, it's only a couple of years after this that we get Saw. And I love Saw. Saw is one of my absolute favorites. And I remember thinking again at the time, it's like, well, shit, all this teeny bopper, you know, kind of, hey, this is fun. That shit ain't going to fly anymore.
Right.
And then that went too far. The pendulum swung back the other way. Like you say, everything is cyclical. Yeah.
That was just the opposite pendulum of the gritty 70s was like Saw was like, we're going to get dirty again and get our hands dirty again. And
the funny part is as we're throughout like that whole idea, well, there's two things. One was that now you had mainstream big time directors making these things. Sleepy Hollow is a perfect example of that. Sleepy Hollow, right? It's Tim Burton, so it's already Tim Burton dies, right? It's all this that whole world and that whole world that Tim Burton lives in, right? But that movie gets away with stuff that you can't get away with. They're killing. They like, well, it killed the mom and the baby. Like, oh, we don't show you that, but like the idea of like what? And that's in a mainstream movie. My wife loved, I mean, I love Sleepy Hollow too.
It was a mainstream horror Hammer movie.
It was not even the same kind of stuff. It wasn't the teeny bop part of it. I mean, it's got Johnny Depp in it and Christina Ricci, but they're not like the young, fresh faces that we're getting from these, whatever. But by the same token, the PG-13 horror that started happening in that part of the 90s, because you had to make it accessible so kids could get it, so you can even get even that younger set of generation into there. I mean, for every remake of like My Bloody Valentine, the remake, the well, I know it's technically it's a remake, but it's really the sequel because it's basically follows the other movie, right? And that had you know, the guys from, I forgot their names. They're from Supernatural, right? Weren't they?
Right.
Yeah. Jensen Ackles.
Yeah. Right. Those they're pretty faces in that movie, but like what that did, at least for, I can speak for my wife, who I went, we went and saw it in 3D. She's like, I go, this is a sequel. She goes, well, what's the first one? So we sat down and watched the first one. She goes, well, this is pretty good. And I was like, and it was right when they first put out the deleted scenes in it and stuff, so that they don't look right because they didn't clean them up. She goes, that looks weird. I go, because that's what, like, but it's like,
it's with My Bloody Valentine, that looks weird. It's Canada. It's just Canada. That's
but it allowed some people.
I know what you said.
Yeah, but I'm saying it allowed some people to maybe go back and look at those other things. But that sweep of PG-13 horror, like Bats with Lou Diamond Phillips and things like those kind of movies. Like those were safe movies they could put on in the middle of the day. And if if your, you know, 10-year-old saw it, it wasn't like, oh my God, but like Tremors or things like that, they were safe horror, quote unquote, right? But they weren't horrific. They were still okay to be able to get there.
There's also a division of like sort of creature features and sort of
right.
Yeah,
it's very much like the Universal.
And we were still, and we still got plenty of creature features in this era too. Mm-hmm. And it's funny again because a lot of them went direct to video, but that market was still being served. Right, there was still enough video stores. Yes, they now rented DVDs also, but that market still was important. It was crucial to a lot of these lower market guys.
Big as well, because you know you had the A-list lining up to be in like Placid or Anaconda.
Or
The Haunting, which is not a creature feature, but these large movies, or even like Arachnophobia, even though that's early 90s.
Anaconda reboot.
Oh boy.
That's different.
All I know is, look, I don't care if you want to turn Anaconda into like a meta comedy. If you get Ice Cube saying they got snakes out there this big, then I will go see your giant snake movie.
So, but and that's one of the great things about, and that's what I think some people don't even kind of realize what we now have, movies. And we just mentioned, like Luke had said, like his oldest is her favorite's Happy Death Day. My daughter, who will swear to God, she doesn't watch movies ever, has seen like every horror movie ever. She watched one horror. She loves those kind of things where they're kind of that there's a little bit of silly to them, but they're still killing and they're still whatever, but not, it's not horrific. Kind of thing. Those wouldn't have existed today because, well, they had to have somewhere to come from, and that's that PG-13 horror. That's that kind of like whatever that kind of moved into the end of the 90s, and then it went away for a little bit and came back because, as you said, the pendulum's got to swing back and forth. And when we watched the pendulum swing back and forth, and you could see it very clearly with, and I know this is not in the 90s, but you saw it with before Twilight and before all those things where it was like going the extreme that way, Dog Soldiers and Ginger Snaps. And Session 9 is very weird in that whole thing, but there's people who were like, wait, a haunted house? Like, what's going on here? That movie is terrifying still to this day. And they don't show you a dang thing. Why? Mm-hmm. Because it kind of showed you what was there. So it allowed people to then say, wait a minute, that's really scary. What else is like that? And while you look at the J horror stuff like Ring You and Dark Water and The Grudge or Juon, right? But then you get a movie like Audition and you're like, what am I watching? Like who in their right mind makes this? And you're like, oh, it's Mikkei. That's why. Because he is an individual. Probably the best way to describe what he is, because
he's his own man.
Right. Because, seriously, when you're sitting there watching this and she says, I'll wait by the phone, and she's staring at the phone and the phone rings and the bag starts moving, you're like, what? What? Like, so, that is so
somebody
hard.
Brought that video over to my house and was like, and I'd never heard of
Mikkei.
And I watched it, and then 2 days later, Ichi the Killer was playing in a theater, and I'm like, oh, I'll go see that.
Could you not have I don't think those movies could be any more different than each other. That's the crazy part.
My eye on this filmmaker, that's what I thought.
But that's the thing, is you had those movies coming out of Japan. You had those movies coming out from other places, which were not doing what we were doing. They were doing their thing, but their thing to that extreme, right? But I'm saying is those kind of things were so influential because then we got our version of The Ring, and the Ring sequels, and we got and the whole world and just you on and all. And then what happens is you now take those influences, much like we saw, and Luke knows that, much like King Kong is the influence, obviously influenced so many things. And like Godzilla, which was influenced by King Kong, obviously, Godzilla influenced so many things. So the influences keep going. So
Right.
what, yeah. So I'm saying is, so when
Yeah, well,
Wes
I was going to
Craven,
say,
we have to
in
do
the
this,
yeah,
we can
and
bring it
when we
back.
get into the yeah, when we get into this era of the 90s, right? Just the dawn, not the dawn, but like moving into that first web 2.0 time frame in the internet, right? It's easier now to not only discuss these films and have the exchange information. You're starting to find the early days of tape trading and stuff like that. The other one you talk about these Japanese films, the other one from this era that I always remember is Night Watch. Right? You talk about a movie that people have completely forgotten about because it was so of its time, but that was just like, what the hell are these guys doing in you know, out in the East, right? But right, it's things like that that may have never had an opportunity if not for this, like I said, this early web 2.0, web 1.0, where we could talk about these things and go to these early horror news sites and stuff like that. Like I remember eSplatter was the one I
Well,
used, you know, and stuff like that.
well, I
yeah,
think that
Nightwatch. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that this whole era, a huge component of it was just the fact that we were all getting online. You know,
Exactly.
we're all emails were new. AOL was the big thing, you know, in the 90s, you know, and you're figuring that out, but you're realizing that there are chat rooms, you know, they're realizing you can reach out to other horror fans, you know, and there are movies that are starting to appear that are turning this opportunity into something that could be very, very dark. You know, Dee Snider puts together Strangeland, you
Yes.
know.
That was on my list. That was I that is such a guilty pleasure because I remember seeing the print ads for that in was that Rue Morgue, Jay? Were you re was that at that point or was
I
that
was reading all of
Fangoria?
them. I was reading all of them at the time. So,
But I remember and I remember we picked that up and I remember no one had heard of that movie and I remember it's such it is such it the first like hour of it is exactly what you think it's going to be, but then the third act is like, where are we going with this one here?
I've
And
never
I
seen it, but I
oh.
remember the posters when it came out
Yes.
and going like, I may stay away from this one.
Well, it's
It's like,
cool. I
yeah,
got
make
Dee Snider is part of the cast as well.
Strangeland.
So yeah, he talks all about Strangeland and it's very, very cool. You know, it's like you can't get everybody, but
No.
we landed some really, really cool folks to talk about their movies. And it's a
That
real treat to be able to have them tell their own story, you know, for the documentary.
sure.
Dee Snider
That's
reminds me
another
of
one of
David Lee
those great
Roth, where he has
direct-to
his
videos of that era.
Dee
Listed to, I'm
Snider
sorry, go ahead, Chris.
reminds me of David Lee Roth, where they both have this like on-stage personality, but then when you get them talking, they're like a college professor, you know, they're
Oh,
very
yeah, very,
composed in
very
their thoughts,
erudite,
they're
articulate
like an
guy.
encyclopedia of knowledge of whatever it is they were into.
No, man, that and I said that we talked again. That's another one of those direct-to-video films. The other another one of that era I keep coming back to, you know, it was Castle Freak by Stuart Gordon, which it's at first like, oh, it's just another full moon. It's like, this one kind of stands out a little bit, right?
Stuart
It's I'm
Gordon,
very proud. This is one of the very few full moons I actually have on VHS, right? Not on DVD. So I do I saw this one. I don't remember if this was a video store closing or what, but I said like, nope, this one's coming home with me. It's got that little moon on it. But yeah, but you know what I mean? There is all this opportunity and the maturity of the video market. The cable market being what it was, is that there was still you still had to we weren't quite where we are today, where now it's so easy, relatively speaking, to make a film shooting on digital and all the editing that go to pick your streaming service of choice, right? And just go to the movies tab and under horror, you'll see just so much schlock that you could make an entire podcast out of this schlock, right? Which I'm not going to say I haven't considered doing, but you know, I'm only so much of a masochist. But you know, if you had to be able to make a film that somebody would then pay to shoot and then print on video or press a disc, right? They had to have a little bit more sometimes, I guess. Maybe I'm just fooling myself with that thought. But you had to, I don't know. To me, it's like the maturity of that market at the time allowed for some really good stuff if you were willing to go hunt for it and find it, you know. And sometimes you got some good stuff. Like sometimes you got Castle Freak and sometimes you got Shrieker. Right, so it wasn't always, it weren't all winners, right? So,
Shrieker. Oh my God. The toy was better than the movie.
The toy was
You
really
can't
cool for
appreciate the
Shrieker.
highs without the lows.
Yeah,
That's
that's right.
all
That's
it
exactly right.
But the one thing I can say though, again, having seen the In Search of Darkness, the three from the 80s, the early 90s, the In Search of Tomorrow, which, oh my God, like I love that. I'm not a sci-fi guy by I mean, I like horror. I like, not that I don't like sci-fi, but I'm watching this going, oh my God, I forgot how many good movies came out that year. Like, it's just like
Oh, yeah.
banger after banger after banger, right, kind of thing. So one of the nice things is that obviously you get such a so many different people who are involved in those things, bringing them in and how in depth they are. And I know we're talking the In Search of here, but just want to mention like the Thing Expanded or Aliens Expanded, like where he's like, this I. As somebody who obviously loves those films, and Luke and I saw the Aliens in the theater with our parents, when we were like, what, 8 and 6, kind of thing. The depth at which you guys bring everything, and not everything's not just a breath of it. Like, you're giving us the information that we as movie people who appreciate these movies and people who are fans of these movies and fans of these individuals, like, and it's not just, well, I'm gonna get let's get this one actor. It's like, okay, which would be great, but like, and you start getting the people who are the person who did the sound, who did this, let alone the special effects people. And and as somebody who, and I build scale figure models and I paint and whatever kind of thing, and I have a number of friends who work in the effects industry. Like, this and as their actual paying job, right? We appreciate the idea of those physical effects, and we appreciate what it takes to do the makeups and stuff like that. And the 90s have that, like you said, that mix of, we still are doing physical, but now there's a little CGI coming in, but there's an art to that CGI,
Little morph here and there.
right? But those physical effects still exist, and when you look at, you can appreciate when something has mass and feeling to it, and the makeups and the whatever's there. That make this hold that special place for you, and it allows you to see. Like, there are times when I'm watching something, let's say some new movie on Shudder that someone threw together, you're like, all right, like I can see the seams, I can see whatever, but I'd much rather they did something physical, kind of thing, as much as like, like the Terrifier movies are over the top kind of thing at times. I
Yeah, but
appreciate
but it's a
it.
physical me.
Right.
Yeah,
I
the fact
appreciate
that
it.
it's practical, you could,
Yeah.
as
Yeah.
an appreciator of film, you
Yeah.
can recognize the effort that was made. And even if not selling it as completely 100% convincing, it
Right.
doesn't
Well,
matter. It doesn't matter. You're much happier that it's a practical effect.
And I think that's one of the big selling points of those type of movies, because we're getting directors and filmmakers now who cut their teeth, like they're making their movies because they watch those same horror movies that you're talking about. They grew up on them, and they're like, oh man, I love this stuff. When Rob Zombie, and again, people either love Rob Zombie or hate him, kind of thing. But Rob Zombie makes a movie, whether you love the movie or not, you cannot deny the what he's drawing influence from, kind of thing. And now that we're getting directors who are now, into their early 20s and into their 30s, they are the children of the 90s. And we're going to, they're you're seeing those influences and those things that were important to us as teenagers, and they were young, younger than we are, and maybe they're into their 40s. That's why those movies, we can connect with the movies now, because we're connecting back to those things that the 90s were talking about. So.
But it's interesting. William Malone, Bill Malone, who did House on Haunted Hill, and he did a bunch of Tales from the Crypt and all sorts of other cool horror stuff. He's in the documentary, and he talks about House on Haunted Hill, and he talks about how he, I mean, among other things, but he mentions that they got kind of he got raked over the coals of that his movie used too much CGI, and the problem was, it didn't. He said there's only two shots that are CG. Everything, but people had gotten to the point where they figured and thought and assumed that everything was CG. That if something was extremely well done, or the way that it was edited, or the way it was lit, or the context that it was used, they just assumed it was CG and they dismissed it. And people were getting talking about fatigue. People were starting to get some CG fatigue that early on. And it's interesting now if you look at present day, and I'm 100% guilty of this. A lot of the stuff I believe and assume is CG when they're using more and more practical effects.
Yep, yep.
But because there's a lot of practical effects where things are sweetened, the sweetening makes me believe that the entire thing is digital. And so I kind of am like, well, I'm appreciating the movie in the moment and the context of how I'm seeing this. But at the end of the day, I'm like, eh, it's CG. But when it's nice to be able to watch the behind the scenes reveal of, say, Alien Earth, where you could see how much is practical.
Everything practical.
You know, not everything. Of course, there's a lot of CG, but so much more than you would think. And because you see all this stuff, you're just like, all right, well, listen, they're still trying. They haven't given up entirely.
Yeah.
Right. Funny thing about the 90s House on Haunted Hill. So I saw that on a double date with my friend Rhett and two girls from Converse College. Okay. We were at Clemson. Converse is a little way up, 85. It's an all girls school, or actually all women's school, right? You can't say girls school. But so we go out and we go see this movie, and this is right before winter break. And we go out to dinner and we go to the movie, and everybody has a great time. And we go back, we hang out at Rhett's dorm room. You know, everybody has a great time, yada, yada, yada. Talk to this girl a couple of times over winter break via email. Get back to a campus spring semester, and I say to Rhett, hey, when are we going to get the girls back down here from Converse? And it's like, oh, dude, yeah, your date was a lesbian, okay? My date, the two of them were girlfriends because my date was bisexual, and she wanted to have a three-way with me and her girlfriend. You were just there for appearances. And I'm like, what the heck, dude?
Yeah, I don't think that story went where I thought it was going. Okay.
No, but the upside is I got to see House on Haunted Hill.
Yeah.
I don't feel bad that I basically got a good night hug. It's like, okay, I didn't have a shot, right?
You so got a good story out of it, too, if anything, right?
So, but, you know, honestly, I guess the thing, you know, folks, if you have not checked out the original three, the ones from the 80s or their first one from the 90s, get on there, check them out. Like, you know, we'll have links and all that stuff for you guys to go check all these things out and get your hands on them. They are well worth your time. I can honestly tell you, I've seen every one of them, but I've watched the 80s stuff over and over. I put it on a loop, but especially when I'm working on a model, if I'm doing a mask or whatever kind of thing, it's just in the background, and I'll be working and I'll stop and I'll listen, because I can listen to them talking because I know what's going on. It's good for the horror soul kind of thing, right? It's good for you to be there. And I can honestly say, I know we appreciate it. And I know I have friends who have reached out and said, when I had said we were having you on to speak, they were like, oh, that's so cool. Those are awesome. And everyone who has ever told about this, when they've sat down and watched them, even if they were like, I don't know, that's a long time, just spend some time. They've enjoyed it. Right. And they're discovering things that they didn't know, like movies, like maybe they weren't as big a horror fan in the 80s, they're discovering it. And I have a feeling that some of my friends who were maybe kind of sliding out of horror and then came back to horror in the 2000s are going to appreciate the ones in the 90s the most, because they're going to rediscover those movies that were kind of on the fringes that they didn't see maybe at the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
I think I'm going to steal your, I'm going to call this chicken soup for the horror. I like that.
Yeah,
I totally like that.
So,
but you guys, listen, you're the real deal because you're passionate about the genre. But you are connected very emotionally in a great way with all this stuff, and the fact that you've been so supportive of these movies is really, of course, wonderful for me. But I understand where that's coming from. You know, I really understand that, and. I think at the end of the day, these documentaries are really good for people who want to reminisce, want to discover stuff, you know, get a little nostalgia. But listen, it's always that one. It's whether it's a clip, whether it's a whole movie, whether it's even a commercial for something, whether it's the sound of like AOL going, you know, there's always something. Like, I remember reading a review. In the first In Search of Darkness, I think I mentioned, you know, we talk about HBO. We showed just a little bit of the and then I very, 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 very particularly picked out a cable box where you have the little snappy buttons at the top all along.
Yes.
The
oh, right, yeah.
That we put on top. And I remember I did that with my my editor, Samuel A. And I was just like, no, you must put this here and you got to put that. And he's just like, yeah, whatever. And then people would say, oh, my God, that moment, it doesn't matter anything else. That took me back to my childhood. And if I can get one thing, one zinger to bring you back to a time that made you very, very, very happy, that can puts you in your safe place in your formative years, then my job is completed. So
you were editor of Famous Monsters for a while.
Yeah.
And I like to think these movies sort of evoke that same spirit of like reading Famous Monsters, where you're not just getting the here's the movie, this is who's in it, this is how it was made and stuff. It's coming from a place of like enthusiasm for the genre. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, you guys
panache to it, you know.
You guys talked to Michael Gingold recently about Slasher Trash, another project that Creator VC, our company, is doing. And boy, he's, you know, talk about the real deal. I mean, he lives, breathes, and eats that stuff, and always has, and has his Fangoria, you know, background. But he's got his dog-eared psychotronic. I think he like sat on that the entire time for Osmosis. But it's like, you know, these things are really, really important for us. So I do apologize because I gotta get in the hook for my family to.
We understand. Oh no, we get it
for dinner. But I wanna do a quick little plug. You know, anyone who's interested in the stuff, please go to 90shorrordoc.com. So 90s, 90shorrordoc.com. All our socials are 80shorrordoc because we built a big following on 80s. So why switch it up to 90s when you have to start again? But 80shorrordoc on, you know, Twitter X and Instagram and Facebook and stuff like that. Go to 90shorrordoc.com. Basically, when this airs, it's basically you have until the end of up until Halloween. So you've all of October until midnight Halloween at the witching hour to go and to get this copy of In Search of Darkness. And it's the second half of the 90s. But we're also offering part one if you missed it. So you can get the whole thing where you're getting part one and part two, which ultimately is going to be 12 plus hours of 90s goodness. If you miss the 80s trilogy, you can get that as well. But fundamentally, what you're doing is you're doing this is our final pre-order. Yeah. So you'll get the movie. We make, manufacture, and distribute this ourselves. But the movie will not be 100% complete because at the end of this final order pre-order campaign, you get to have your name in the credits. And we're also going to do the thing where if you record yourself on video talking about what you love about 90s horror or your favorite film or just your passion for the genre, you can submit it to us and you might even end up in the end credits pontificating about what you love 30 seconds or less. But yeah, so I really appreciate you guys giving me, an opportunity to go down through memory lane. But, just a little soapbox because we're a small company, you know, so word of mouth is incredibly important. And your passion for the horror genre, but also for these projects means a lot to me and means a lot to us at Creator VC. So I really thank you guys.
Yeah, we really appreciate you being on. We appreciate everything you're doing for the horror genre and all this stuff. It was a great opportunity to get you on to speak about these things because we talk about it all the time. And it's like, we want to connect a little behind the scenes of that stuff. And you gave us that information, which is also great too. And I'll be honest is that, I pushed it all kind of thing. If you watch to the end of the first set of the 90s, you might see a face people might recognize standing next to the Bride of Frankenstein. I'm not saying it's me talking about freaks, but it is. We appreciate it. We love having you on. You're always welcome back anytime you'd like to come on.
Thank you.
Even if you want to just talk about any movie, we're good to go. But anything you want to talk about, we're totally enjoying the heck out of it because we love finding people who are passionate about this, about the same stuff that we're passionate about. So
very
David,
cool. Very cool.
Thank you very much. We all here appreciate everyone at Two True Freaks, the whole kit caboodle of all of us. Truly appreciate everything you're doing and what you're giving to everybody.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Fun to talk with you guys today.
All great.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Test, test, say duh.
Duh.
Good luck.